What we are dealing with now is two chapters, really, and the chapter divisions here are a little unfortunate because chapter 10 probably should start with verse 16 of chapter 9. So I'm going to actually read it that way. And we're going to capture the context here because Solomon is going to tell us the dangers of folly and foolishness. So I'll start with Ecclesiastes 9, verse 16. Follow along in your brain. Don't let your brain check out. And just listen to what the Word of God says. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. Chapter 10, verse 1 is really a continuation of the thoughts of the limitations of wisdom. A little folly could destroy the reputation of a wise man, a wise and honorable man. One sinner can destroy much good. And wisdom was not valuable to the poor man when it came down to it. Now in verse 2, we change and he begins to write about the characteristics of wisdom and foolishness. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses and princes walking as servants upon the earth. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Whoso removeth stones shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. If the iron be blunt, and he do not whet the edge, then must he put to more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell him? The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not how to go to the city. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles, and thy princes eat in due season, for strength and not for drunkenness. By much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands the house droppeth through. A feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things. Curse not the king. No, not in thy thought, and curse not the rich in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. Now you might at first glance go, wow, that is a lot of data, a lot of words, and you would be right. You could make this easily into a 10-point sermon, because in essence, that is what this is. It's a list of 10 different thoughts. 10 different chunks of thought. We have here the built into each passage the contrast between foolishness or folly and wisdom. Now, I don't know about you, but I went to a public high school. And I have noticed, maybe you have noticed, that there is a lot of foolishness that goes on in public high schools. Have you ever noticed that? I have. I remember one day sitting in a trigonometry class. How many of you like trigonometry? Just curious. Anybody? All right, great. You're a lot better than I am. I hated trigonometry. I wish I paid more attention, although I'm not really sure what I'd use it for today. But I was sitting in trigonometry class by someone, and this other boy behind me was poking the guy's head in front of him. And he was just doing this thing where he had his book, and the teacher was lecturing, and he would go and went poke him with his pencil. And then the guy would say, "Knock it off." And he'd go, "What? Who's him?" If you ever do that, don't raise your hand if you've ever done that to someone. I didn't do it. It was him. Did it again. What? It was him. Just kept doing it the entire time. I don't know how long this went on until finally, can you guess what happened? The guy who was being poked basically slammed his book down, turned around, and he had a good fist. One of those big ones, you know, that you can really punch hard with. And he just cut loose and slugged the guy right in the nose. It was one of those days when there was yet another trail of blood leading to the principal's office. And everyone in the class was just sort of shocked, and some people were laughing, and the teacher's lesson was blown that day. There are a lot of fights that go on in high school. Maybe you've seen the fight where two fools square off against one another for whatever provocation, whatever it was, and they're each waiting for the other one to take the first push. Have you ever seen this? The one guy goes like that, and the other guy backs up. And then he goes and pushes him. And it's like they're not sure if they want to push or they want to punch. And so finally, the one guy throws the first punch, and then they're on the ground, and then the principal comes running down the hallway, or the science teacher, or whoever is brave enough to break them apart. Now, that was when I was in high school in the 80s. Nowadays, you have police officers in high schools, and they don't really put up with that like they did in the 80s. I mean, in the 80s, you might occasionally get a teacher going, yeah, slug him, get him up. No, you don't get that today. No teacher is going to take sides against the bully in that way. They want to keep their job. But foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, right? That is what the scriptures teach. Have you found that it's bound up in your heart? Do you find during the course of a week that, yes, it's more evident in high school, but in the workplace, it's seen as well? I mean, if you were to make a list of people at work that you would say are wise and those that you would say are fools, could you do that? And isn't it true, folks, that we still, as Christians, we have the flesh within us, and there is still this built-in propensity for us to do foolish things? Every time a husband does not love his wife like Christ loves the church, he's being foolish. Every time a Christian wife refuses to submit to her husband and follow his leadership, she's being foolish. In this chapter, Solomon is pointing out the danger, the real danger of just giving vent to that. Have you ever felt like, you know what, it's hard to be a Christian, I'm ready to just stop. I would like to have one day off from being a Christian. Well, you better be careful. Because the Bible teaches that the way of a transgressor is what? It's hard. There's built-in inherent danger in foolishness. You can't just keep poking the kid in front of you and not eventually get slugged in the face. Sometimes you might avoid it. Maybe you're a better fighter, but he who lives by the sword could die by it. And so we have in this passage the danger of folly. The first thing I want to point out to you from verses 2 and 3, well, I guess we'll do verse 1. Verse 1 continues on the thought of the limitations of wisdom when it says, "Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor." Of course, back then in the days of Solomon, there was no air conditioning and there was no sophisticated deodorant that you could pick up at Walmart. And there was no, I mean, there was a lot of bugs. And so let's say that you were an apothecary, someone who makes valuable perfumes or fragrances. It would be very easy for a bug to land in your beautifully smelling fragrance and die a horrible death there. And all it took was one large beetle, some ancient insect of the Middle East, a couple of, dare I say, a roach. Did they exist back then in Solomon's day? And that beautiful smelling stuff is just going to stink. The point here is that even a wise man, look at the verse again, a man who has reputation for wisdom and honor, it says at the end of the verse, that individual, if he just does a little something offhand, he can ruin his reputation quite easily. For example, have you ever met someone that you think very highly of and they curse? They use a cuss word in front of you. Doesn't that sort of impinge their character? Or have you met a Christian that you really respect and they just fly off the handle and they get mad? I remember I was around a pastor, a friend of mine, and his son was about this tall, and his son did something foolish, and he just exploded at him and said, I can't believe you did this. And I looked around at the faces of the other people in the church. They were watching this, and they weren't very enthusiastic about it. Now, the man was a good man, and you might know someone who is wise and honorable. But in those unguarded moments, you and I can endanger our reputation by doing something as simple as what I just mentioned. It's like the fly. All it takes is one little fly. And wisdom can be limited. Folks, remember, the wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God. Losing your temper, giving vent to how you really feel, all it takes is one time. And folks, I think we all are in danger of that from time to time, and perhaps we're all guilty of it from time to time. But we ought to use this as a warning to the danger of folly. Just like he said in the preceding verse of chapter 9, one sinner can destroy much good. So one offhand comment, one little off-color joke could ruin your testimony before a group of people. And we ought to seek for God's help, because we're all sinners and we need the grace of God to help us to maintain a good testimony. Well, in verses 2 and 3, let me just sort of put this together a little bit for you. If you look at verses 2 and 3, he begins to speak, or shifting away from the weaknesses of wisdom, the limitations of wisdom, and just talking outright about folly. In verses 2 and 3, we see sort of the source of foolishness. It says a wise man's heart is in the right place, basically, is the idea. But a fool's is not. So we see that from the heart, there is this source of folly. In the next section there, we see in verses 4, 5, 6, and 7, that folly, surprisingly, is sometimes found in a ruler. Look at verse 4. If the spirit of the ruler do certain things, verse 5, there's something that proceeds from the ruler, and Solomon says in verse 5, it's an evil. It's possible for folly to live in the hearts of leaders and for them to do stupid things, unwise things. Then you look down at verses 8 and 9 and you see that folly is inherently dangerous. Because in verse 8, there's someone who's digging a pit. Now, in the ancient world, there really aren't a whole lot of reasons to dig a pit. The context here is he's digging it for someone else to fall into it. And it says in the verse that there's this person who breaks a hedge. Now, the only reason you're really going to break a hedge is, in this context, it's the idea of breaking through to steal. The picture here is of a bandit and a thief. And even in the midst of his activities, he can hurt himself. And then it kind of moves on to verse 9 to building and chopping wood, and you could get hurt then. And so it's sort of the idea that folly is really dangerous because the world itself is dangerous. Accidents happen, and that makes folly even more dangerous. Someone who is trying to steal something may get hurt in the process, just as someone who is cutting with an axe and doing something honorable can cut his own foot off. It's It's a dangerous world. Folly is inherently dangerous because of the world in which we live. You continue down through and you look at verse 10, and there is iron that's blunt or an axe that is not sharpened, and he do not whet the edge. Then you have to put in more strength in order to get a cut. But wisdom is profitable. And so we learn that there is some value to wisdom. And then he just goes on, he kind of just throwing out there, folly does this and folly does that. A fool does this with his words. But I do want to point out before we go through this with a little more detail that there are leaders mentioned repeatedly in this passage. If you look at verse 4 again, it's the ruler that rises up against thee. In verse 5, the ruler that honors folly and puts the wrong people in the wrong positions. You look down at verse 16, and it's the king being a child. Now, it's not a literal child. Really, what's being spoken of is an inexperienced, naive, foolish man. And princes who eat in the morning, they're party animals, and they don't take care of the things of the estate, or I should say the state. And I think there's some definite applications here for us. The kind of country that we live in today, the kind of people that live in this country, we've come up with a word for people that are around us that don't work. We use the word sluggard in the Bible, but have you ever heard the word slacker? And is it possible for slackers to be in leadership positions? It sure is. Now, I'm not railing against anyone in government today, but I do want to get to verse 20 because he does give us, and we'll get there in a moment, what we should do. We should continue to respect and be wise with our words, even in the midst of slackers and sluggards. So where does folly proceed from? Verses 2 and 3, look at it again. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. Now, we know what Jesus said about the heart. There was this big controversy, and I read this passage last week, so I'm just going to remind you of it. There was a controversy over the washing of cups and platters and this rite and ritual that the Pharisees did and taught their disciples to do. It was sort of like holy water. Now, I don't know how many of you have been present when you have seen holy water used in a Catholic ceremony, but the idea of holiness residing in an object is very common in all kinds of religions. I remember once watching a documentary about the Nepalese people, and there were those who lived way up in the mountains, and they had shrines on the hillsides, and they had prayer wheels, little things they would spin. And so if you wanted good luck and you wanted sort of a touch of the god, you would walk by and just spin those on your way out, I guess taking your yak out to the mountainside, spin the wheels a couple times. And that's a shrine. That's holy. Or you might go to a site in the Muslim religion, like the Dome of the Rock, and here is this holy site, and you know what? You take that away from us, we're going to war, brother. We're not going to put up with it. And you and I would immediately say that that's rubbish. There's nothing holy about spinning an object or going to a place. Those things are not intrinsically holy. But sometimes you and I are in danger of committing sort of the opposite heresy in saying that some things are inherently evil in and of themselves. Now, I want to be careful about what I say, because sin is always sin. But the scriptures are clear that we can't blame our environment for the things that we do. You might have grown up in a horrible household, but you can't blame your parents for the sins that you commit. There has to come a time in your life when you take responsibility for yourself. This passage is one of those passages that reveals to us that there is a heart that the wise man has that's in the right place. That's why he's wise. And it is not because of his upbringing per se, or the books that he's reading, or that he lives in a particular location, or that he grew up in the household of a priest, an Episcopal priest, or an Anglican one. But because there's something different about his heart. Now, folks, where is your heart this morning? Has the God of heaven touched your heart and changed it? Do you remember what Nicodemus said to Jesus? Jesus talked about coming to the new kingdom and you have to be born again. And Nicodemus was confused and he said, how's that even possible? We be born all over again. And Jesus handled him very, bluntly. He said, look, are you a teacher of Israel? You don't understand this. The idea is that God takes away the stony heart and puts in its place a sensitive heart, a heart that can respond to God. If you were to describe your heart this morning, would you describe it as a heart that's sensitive to God or insensitive? If you were to make this kind of decision about yourself, my heart is on the right hand or the left. In this case, in the Hebrew mindset, it's the place where it should be is the right hand, the place where it shouldn't be is the left. Where is your heart this morning? You see, the fact is that the best self-help books, the best morning television, the best psychologist or psychiatrist, the best exercise routine, none of these things are going to change the real issue, and that is the heart. And the heart, according to Solomon, it will express itself. Look at verse 3 again. The heart expresses itself. It says that there's this fool who walks by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. The idea of walking by the way is it's a common everyday experience. It's just sort of what we do, right? They would walk along. I mean, a common equivalent would be there is a fool and he was carpooling. And the things that he said, he told everyone in his carpool just by the everyday speech that he was really a fool. And so there is what Jesus said, out of the overflow of the heart, if it's in right, you're going to get good things. If it's not, you're going to get foolish things. So you know one of the ways you can tell whether your heart is in the right place? What have you been saying today or this week? What words are coming out of your mouth? Are they words that line up with what the scriptures say? Or have your words been way out in left field, way apart from a Christian worldview? Solomon lets us know that foolishness is dangerous. It comes from the heart. It proceeds out into the mouth and into our actions. Verse 4. Then he starts speaking about the spirit of a person. Look at verse 4. He says, if the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. He moves from the heart to the spirit. Here's someone who just gets angry. They're your leader and they really lose it. And they are really upset with you. Now, the tendency for you and me would be to either lash out and to finally tell them what we've always wanted to tell them. Or to just sort of pass out and we just leave. We walk quietly and fade away and we give in even though the man is dead wrong. Here is the idea of just peaceably remaining where you are. You're not giving an inch to the things that he says that are wrong or unjust, but neither are you lashing out in wrath. You're just sort of a quiet answer turns away wrath. Are you familiar with that proverb? That's the thinking here. You could be in a situation where you are a wife and your husband says some very foolish things to you. And you're going to be sorely tempted to say in kind to him. Ladies, don't raise your hands, but has that ever really worked? Would you say that's a successful strategy to take? To sin with your words like your husband just did. To add sin to his sin. Does that really work? It doesn't. It could be the other way. It could be a husband who's just heard sinful words from his wife and she's upset with him. Now, she's not his ruler. He's supposed to be the head of his home, but he could respond in kind. But there is this kind of a spirit. Look at it again in the King James Version. It says, yielding pacifieth great offenses. There is this sort of quiet, meek spirit that's of great value to God, What am I quoting from the New Testament, ladies? The kind of spirit that Christian wives should have. And you know what, men? It works in the workplace and in politics, having that sort of quiet strength. You're in the right. You just remain firm, but you don't explode in wrath. And that is wise to do that. The spirit of a ruler can rise up against us because rulers are sinners. Look at verse 5. There's an evil which I have seen under the sun as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Now, here's the idea of a ruler who is making decisions. And his decision, verse 6, is he is going to take the fool and put him in a place of great dignity. And the one who is rich, now, it's not the one that deserves a position because of his wealth per se, but it's the one who's demonstrated his wisdom by his what he's done with his money. That person is going to have to sit in a low place. And so verse 7, you've got a switch. People that should be honored aren't honored, and people that are honored should be honored. Now, in American politics, we always grumble. When the Republicans are in power, the Democrats grumble. When the Democrats are in power, the Republicans grumble. And that's politics in our nation. And we are privileged to be able to vote per our conscience and with freedom and to have a freedom of religion in our country. That is our privilege. But isn't it true that no matter who is in power, say an independent came to power, become president, that because that they're all sinners, would you agree, folks, that Republicans are sinners, Democrats are sinners, and independents are sinners, that everybody's a sinner? Would you just agree with that? Probably. Is it not true that probably, regardless of who's in power, there will be those times when a fool is put into a position he never should have been in? That's what Solomon's saying. Now, when he says here in this verse, if you look at verse 5, I have seen under the sun, this is not to be taken as a parable. This is what he has actually seen. Every time you see that, he's not just making this up off his head like a story. He has seen it happen. And sometimes it happens in our lives as well. And so foolishness can be found in your house and my house and the White House. It's everywhere. And it's a dangerous thing. Now, verses 8 and 9 talk about the danger of this world. I don't know how many of you have ever been out working in your garden and you have hurt yourself. There are some very common dangers out there in this life. When I was a child, I went to Perry Hall Baptist School. And every day, my dad taught there. He was a science teacher for 2 years. And so in grades 4 and 5, that was the only time I've ever gone to a Christian school. We would commute from Harford County, get on Route 1, and drive straight down Route 1 into Perry Hall on Schroeder Avenue, where Perry Hall Baptist Church is and where the school is. We had a little Dodge Colt. It was about the size of a soda can. I mean, it was a very dangerous car, but it got great gas mileage, so that's why we had it. We had to commute a half hour, 45 minutes one way. We were driving back one day, and a bus was on our right hand, and it was blocking the view from a restaurant off of Route 1, and the guy pulled out right in front of the bus, and he didn't know that we were in the other lane, and lo and behold, of course, we smacked right into him. And it's a terrifying thing for a fourth grader to be sitting in the front seat, and here comes this car, right into us. I was pretty scared. How many of you have ever been in an accident, car accident? Most of us. That's the kind of world we live in. The common things we do can be extremely dangerous. I remember one time I was digging footers with my dad. Bless his heart. He was teaching. We were digging footers with pickaxes and shovels, not a backhoe. And we were digging and digging and digging. It was my turn to use the pick, and I was just picking away. And then he handed me the shovel to get the dirt out. And I missed the dirt, and I swung that shovel up. This shovel was like 15 to 20 years old. It had dug so much dirt, the inside of it was indented, and it was sharpened from all that digging. And I just rammed it right into his leg. Oh, I wonder why he was mad at me. It was an accident. Accidents happen. Now,
on the best of days when you and I are walking with Christ and we are not being foolish, you can still have those things happen to you, right? It wasn't that I was meditating on Satan while I was digging dirt. I was digging dirt. And when we were driving home, my dad was just driving home to get to his family. How foolish is it, folks, to compound the danger of this world by being a fool on top of it? Isn't it enough that you could get into a car accident? How much more stupid to drink and drive? Isn't it enough that you can go out onto a work site and you can get hurt, but to go out there with a hangover where you can't focus? This happens constantly. I was working with a job once. The man was driving a fork truck stoned on drugs. We were picking up huge pieces of equipment. Who's going to drive? I'll drive. There he goes. It's one of the few jobs I quit. I quit after 2 weeks because I didn't want to die. I prefer life. But here it is. So Solomon is saying there is this danger to foolishness. The world is already so dangerous. Don't add the foolishness on top of it. You could dig a pit. Verse 9. You're going to remove stones. You could drop one on your foot or on somebody's head. You're cleaving wood. You could be in danger by it. So, verse 10, he ends these three verses with the idea of wisdom. You know what? If you're wise, you can reduce your workload. Work smarter, not harder. Look at verse 10. If the iron be blunt and he do not whet the edge, then must he put to more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. In other words, sharpen your axe. You probably heard the story of the youth who went out to work at a lodge, and he went out to the woods to help them clear the area. And he had gotten the job because he was a big, strong fella, and he really knew how to swing an axe and clear some brush. And so he was out there working with the older men, and they were just cutting circles around him. And the foreman comes out and says, you know what, I'm just going to have to get rid of that guy because he looks strong, but he's not cutting half as much as these older guys. But he said, I'm going to go talk to him because I know he's really working hard. And he gets the guy over and says, my friend, I really appreciate all the effort you're putting into this. I can tell you're just the sweat's dripping off of you. You're really working hard, but you're hardly producing. You know, what's going on? The guy said, well, I'm really working as hard as I can. And the guy thought, oh, have you stopped to sharpen your axe? Oh, I don't have time to do that. I didn't want to do that because I didn't want to give any time to it. How much more would he have cut if he had sharpened his axe? The older men were working circles around him. The application here for you and me would be to take time to be holy. Speak oft with thy Lord. Because in the rush of the day, folks, the song talks about how we shouldn't rush ahead of him. And we can make foolish decisions. And our best will be less than our best because we are not walking hand in hand with our Lord on a given day. We should be like David, whose heart was after the Lord and who sought him. And we should take warnings from the life of Joshua, that time when he didn't seek counsel from the face of the Lord and he made an alliance with the people that he should have destroyed. And those people were a perpetual pain to Israel all their days. All the way to the days of Saul and David and so on. Maybe you're here today and you know that you have not read your Bible for weeks. Weeks have gone by and you have not prayed. Folks, how dull is your axe? And you realize, wow, I'm just falling into temptation. I'm just caving in to the things of the flesh. I'm losing my temper. I'm thinking thoughts I shouldn't think. What's happening to me? It's because you're trying to do something with a dull axe. And that is a dangerous thing. Men, you and I face temptations in this world right now that our fathers never faced. All it takes is the click of a mouse button. All it takes is being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And you and I can fall into deep sin. Please, brothers, keep your axe sharp. Go to your workplace with a mind that's saturated with the scriptures. Be close to your God. You don't want a blunt, as it says in verse 10, a blunt iron. Verse 11 talks about the serpent biting without enchantment. Now, in the King James Version, the word enchantment here is not talking about magic per se. It's just the picture of a snake charmer. And the idea here is of someone who is out and he has his instrument and he takes forever to set it up. The snake is sitting there. The snake is sitting there. The snake is sitting there, and he just never gets around to charming it. And so the snake bites him. That's the picture. Verse 11, a babbler is no better. Now, a babbler is someone who is constantly talking about things he should not or she should not talk about. Eventually, a babbler might actually do it. You could have a friend at work, and they have been talking about leaving their husband for years. You could have a friend at work, and he has been flirting with an affair, and they're babbling about it. Now, the reason the snake bit the charmer is because he took too long to get out his instrument and play. And your responsibility as a Christian should be to cut the babbler off with speed, because it might be too late. If you wait too long to reprove someone who's flirting with sin, after a while, they just get hardened in it and then they go jump. And there could be someone here today who is flirting with sin. And I want to warn you, friend, to stop. See, folks, what we have here is the fact that folly is dangerous. Whether it's in the White House, your house, whether it's in the relationships at work, it's something that you and I should avoid. If we choose wisdom, what is the beginning of it? The fear of the Lord, right? For a moment, I want you to think about this table. We're about to transition into it. We don't have time for the rest of the passage this morning. Solomon wrote in Proverbs that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Here is what God did for you and me. He knew how foolish we are and were. He knew every sin we were going to commit. And he decided before the foundation of the world to send a sin sacrifice to die for us. And when we trust in Christ and the blood of the cross, he takes away the guilt of our sin, and he puts his spirit within us. Old things are passed away. All things have become new. That means that God lives inside of you, Christian. Your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. And what that means is you are now never alone. He never leaves you alone to your folly. We have an internal struggle day to day. But the Spirit of God is within us. And it says in Galatians that if you walk in the Spirit, you will not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. In other words, it's like this, folks. God has neutralized the folly of our hearts by giving us a plan, another door to walk through. And that's what he calls it. He says that when we're taken in temptation, there's always going to be a door to escape. And part of that door is submitting to the fact that the Spirit of God lives within you if you're here today as a believer. That means that you don't have to give in to the foolish things your heart is thinking. Folks, what is your heart thinking that's been foolish this week? Have you been thinking of doing something that you know God would not want you to do? You know what? You do not have to give into that. You don't have to play with fire. Yield to the Spirit of God. Obey the Scriptures. Jesus died so that you could do that. He shed his blood so that you could say no to sin. And it's a horrible shame when you don't make use of the access you have to God.